Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Wagon, with me, Finty Williams, and my co-host and all-round excellent human being, John McEwan. This week, finding ourselves in the strange world of lockdown, we are, of course, doing interviews from the safety of our own homes. This podcast is made possible by the help of the amazing Ibiza Calm, a residential rehab and treatment facility. We are so very grateful for the extraordinary work they do and for the help that they're giving us. This week, we are incredibly lucky to be joined by the wonderful broadcaster, writer and presenter, Adrian Childs. Adrian, thank you so much for giving up your time.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely not at all. I'm worried you're going to harangue me somewhat because I'm writing a book. I'm writing a book called How to Drink Less rather than How to Stop Drinking. So this might be heretical. Yes. If so, then feel free to have a go at me. But I've always loved talking to John, and I can tell I'm going to love talking to you as well.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Brilliant. Well, I'll start the haranguing, which I did, I think, when you first came to the office that day. But I just want to acknowledge, you know, particularly the documentary that you made, Drinkers Like Me, because I know it touched so many people. I mean, we're talking millions, not hundreds. And I think it was mainly just down to your honesty, your openness about your alcohol consumption, your depression, and the struggle. So we would really like to touch on the struggle, I think, today, because as you say, and we know this, it's not about you being on the wagon as such. It's about how you've personally struggled with cutting down, the sort of pros and cons of that, and where you're at now in that journey. And obviously we want to touch on the lockdown issue as well in terms of how that's affecting you. So if I can start with, you were drinking over 80 units some weeks.
Yeah.
And you were working really hard to bring that down. And you'd spoken to lots of other professionals about this issue. Where are you at? Are you at now?
Now I am at about somewhere, I would say if you averaged it out over the last 20 weeks, I'd be somewhere around 20 units a week.
Right.
Wow.
Right. Okay. And has that increased during this last few weeks, given the pressure that's on a lot of us?
No, it's not. I mean, it's kind of a separate conversation, but for my sort of mental state as it is, lockdown actually suits me because I found out it just takes the options away. It's just, it's taking the temptations away to go out, the guilt trips about going out to see people and maybe people that I feel I have to drink with because that's what we've always done. You know, it's taken that away. So I've ended up drinking a lot less. And I've also become painfully aware, to get back to your sort of previous question, just how, your original question is just how circumstances can change things. So two noticeable things. One, my girlfriend moved in with me. Now she drinks, but not much. You know, she would drink, you know, she'll probably drink 2 or 3 days a week. She's not the kind of person who's just going to, let's open a bottle of wine. It's 6 o'clock. Now, if it was, I'm sure I would have gone with the flow with that. But because she's not, it's meant I cut down my drinking. Also, the guy I used to have my early morning pints with, it'd only be a couple of pints. But I was having about, if you remember, John, I'll just say, I beat my mate after work. We'd have a couple of pints every day. That was just the baseline.
Mm.
Right. So that in itself, 2 pints a day, let's call that 28, you know, let's call that, what is that, 14 pints a week. Well, you're up to 30 units just to be at zero. You see what I mean? But that went out the way simply because he moved a mile in the other direction. So because to meet him at home now, I'd have to go in the other direction to the way I normally go. I won't expect, but it just became a bit less convenient. So we stopped doing it. So immediately I lost about 20 units a week through that. So it's by happenstance that it kind of happened. But that's not to say it hasn't been, you know, it hasn't been a struggle.
Yeah, yeah. I think, again, because you talked about it a fair bit on the documentary, but I know kind of, I think we had a chat once off camera in another place, and you were saying you didn't realise how tough it was cutting down, you know, some of the sort of physical side to that, and obviously the psychological side, whether that was not going out as much, seeing friends, the social side that you've just touched on. Could you just say a little bit more about that, how difficult it's been? Because I think that's why people stopping. Yeah.
Well, you know, my life was built around alcohol. And I mean, in quite a gentle way, although you might contest that. But just that most of my friends I'd met through sort of drinking with them, being in pubs with them, having a good time. You know, generally no fighting or stupidity or even particularly drinking to excess. So I always had friends with whom, you know, when I meet up with them and I might not see them for 2 or 3 months at a time, it was just natural that we had a drink. So I constantly had to focus on managing that. But the key thing is that if you just stop drinking, you make the decision to stop drinking, that's one big decision, and it's not easy. It's not easy to make that decision, and it's not easy to follow through. But I would suggest in some ways it's a lot easier than moderating, because you have just made one big decision. Everybody knows where you're at, and it just takes the decision-making, it takes the social pressure out. If you've made that decision, everyone knows it. Nobody's going to start badgering you to come out for a drink. Nobody's going to start putting pints in front of you. But if you're just moderating, then you've got 100 decisions to do every week. It's absolutely exhausting. So, you know, what do I drink? What time do I start drinking? When do I stop drinking? Who do I drink with? You know, who don't I drink with? You know, so I meet a certain friend on a Tuesday who I haven't seen for 6 months. I think, well, you know, it's almost like I'm not taking the relationship serious if I don't have a couple of pints with him. So on Wednesday, I see another friend who I'm not drinking with. I said, what did you do last night? I said, well, I met X and we had a few pints. He might go, oh, I see. So he will drink with him, but not with me. Now, I mean, I'm slightly exaggerating, but sort of not very much. And it's gradually learning to sort of manage that, which has been the secret to it, I think. And I can't stress enough how important it is, you know, to count the units that you're drinking. I mean, that is the beginning and the end of all of it for me, that you've got to, you know, you've just got to be honest with yourself be honest with yourself mainly, and just count how much you were drinking. And it's not that difficult. If I hadn't been forced to do that by a television program, I would never have known. I would have suspected, but I would never have known for sure I was drinking as much as I did. And now counting my unit, so every day a thing pops up on my phone basically asking me how much I drank yesterday. I sort of know that's coming, and I input it. So that forces you to drink mindfully. You are then forced to think, hang on, so I had those 10 units yesterday. Was that worth it? You know, was that really worth it? Could I have made do with 2 units? Do you know what I mean? You know, and so it forces you to sort of value every drink a little bit more, drink more mindfully. Because as I said to you at the time of when I made the program, is that what I struggled to come to terms with was the awful truth that, you know, if I'd lined up all the drinks I'd drunk in my life since I was 15, that line of drink could be 4 miles long.
Wow.
Now, the tragedy for me isn't so much that, you know, my liver got in a bit of a state, and it's not even so much that I did all that drinking. It is the fact that I asked myself, of that 4 miles of drinks, how many of those did I really want, need, or enjoy? Right. And I don't think it's more than a third. Right. So, I mean, that's 2/3 of all the drinking I've done has been pointless. Just sheer habit. You know, drinking for the sake of drinking. And that's mad. I mean, to have damaged myself for that, or even just have spent all that bloody money or accumulated all those calories, it's just stupid.
Yeah.
You know, it's like overeating every day, you know, pointlessly.
You've sort of answered this, but if I can ask in a more direct way, but do you subscribe to the, I'm an addict, I have this compulsion, that kind of, despite me having 10 yesterday, I might still have 10 today. Do you know what I mean? In terms of that, some people call it a voice, some people call it the ism. Yeah.
Well, on that, I would, you know, my issue with that is the more I've read about it, the more people I've spoken to. You know, I understand addiction, and I think I had a form of addiction. What I struggle with is this, I don't know whether you'd call it the disease model or this binary aspect to it, where you are either an addict or you're not. When in fact, I think we're all on a kind of a continuum. You know, so I had, yes, a level of addiction. You know, I had some level of addiction to alcohol. But, you know, I think we're all on a kind of a spectrum there. And where you draw that line, I think it's almost fruitless to try drawing that line, really, or to have that line. Just, you know, if you are, you know, we're all somewhere on that spectrum is kind of my belief. And I'll happily suspect at some level I was, you know, I was addicted, absolutely.
Yeah. One last one from me before. Yeah. I know Finn's going to come in and ask a few things.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You're holding on to this, what I'm going to call a drug, alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've got apps, you've got social things in and out of your diary to help you. As you say, there's an external, which I think is really relevant to everybody, actually. Well, most people who drink and who often drink excessively, that what we do need is an external voice rather than an internal voice. So I think apps and friends are really useful when it comes to you know, kind of saying, hey, steady, slow down, because we don't always have that kind of internal kind of gauge or whatever you want to call it. But it's obviously more important for you to still have that drink despite all that work than to not. What do you think about that?
I think kind of, you know, yes, it is. If I can bring my drinking to a safe level or safe-ish level, then I'm almost bloody-minded about it. Just think, well, I'm going to prove it is possible. Right. So, I mean, there's that aspect of it. I mean, also, I think there are benefits. I mean, I often say about, you know, I talk a lot about religion, and I'm no big God squatter, so, you know, don't worry about that. But now I would say, and I would, you know, I often say religion itself or faith itself isn't the problem. It's what you do with it. You know, it's like it's like water. You know, you can drown in it, but you need it to survive. Fire, you can burn to death, or you can use it to heat your food. And in a way, I'd say the same about alcohol. It's kind of what you do with it that is the issue. Now, I think it can, at a moderate level, you know, in the fact that it gets people talking, the social lubricant, and that I can just about construct a case that in the whole, and I'm using my language carefully here, not just because you're listening, no, it might do less harm. It might do less harm than good. Right. So that's my kind of view. And I don't think there's enough advice out there to really moderate, to really, you know, to really help you use it better. The industry, though, deny this, is intent on getting you in the bracket of drinking about 50 units a week. I don't think the industry wants you to die drinking, but I think it wants you to drink at above safe levels. That's where all its profits are. I mean, it's easy enough to see. So they don't want it. Then you've got what you might call the temperance lobby, although that old-fashioned terms, I wouldn't use that in writing, but they'll say, don't drink at all. And just, I think there's a paucity of advice in just how to manage it, you know, how to manage it properly. Right, just briefly, I went on a retreat to Australia for reasons I won't sort of too long and boring to go into. But and there, it was really interesting. For a week, it was right, no alcohol, no coffee, no sugar, and I think no gluten as well. I mean, it's not quite as mad as it sounds, but I did end up doing talking horse therapy where I told a horse all my problems. Okay. But I was so much in the zone, it actually moved me no end. But anyway, what was interesting about that, two things. A, I found out what I'm addicted to is bloody caffeine. I mean, the first two or three days were unbelievable. I mean, everyone said they got headaches. I didn't get that. But literally, if I sat down, I fell asleep for 2 days. It was extraordinary. Yeah, I've got one here. But the other thing was, we had all these lectures about it, and some were from proper scientists, there was a bit of sort of quackery, new age quackery going on. But so there's all this advice on how to quit caffeine, how to quit sugar, how to quit gluten, how to quit alcohol. But then And so everybody nodded and everyone said they felt great. And then everybody went home. What there wasn't a single bit of advice about in there was how to moderate, which is what in the end, what people are going to have to do. There wasn't a single bit of advice on, right, caffeine. Even on that, said, right, again, do what I did, how to drink less coffee. I have one in the morning now, and that's it. Right, and so, and I'm mindful of, again, it was I realised how much coffee I was drinking pointlessly. It's a bit like alcohol. The first one gives you a bit of a hit. After that, it's just sheer habit.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wish they got into that a bit more. Because don't we all felt great after a week? And don't we all felt great? You know, send us away with something, news we can use, you know, advice we can actually deploy in the real world.
Yeah.
I have to say, Adrian, I rewatched your documentary last night and the thing that struck me the most out of all of it was I have been in rehab several times and I struggled for quite a long time to stop drinking.
Yeah.
But what absolutely struck me was your honesty about it. I wasn't as honest as that, and I was drinking a lot, probably as much as you.
Yeah.
If not quite a lot more. But that level of honesty was so extraordinary to hear. Did you struggle with being that honest?
Absolutely not.
Was that hard?
Absolutely not. 2 years or a year or so before that, I made a documentary about religion where I said, like, I believe in God. This is why. And I think basically Jews, Christians and Muslims are all the same. They believe in the same God, blah, blah, blah. And we went around Europe looking at it. Now, to me, that was much more honest and much riskier. There was much more jeopardy around that. I thought I was going to end up getting shot to pieces by Jews, Christians and Muslims. As it happened, the only stick I got from evangelical Christians, who were the worst ever. I mean, they were awful. But, you know, I'll tell you a story, John, which will make you laugh when we're not on when we're not on air. But I spoke to one of my all-time sporting heroes and it turned out he was an absolute rank Islamophobe. You know, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. But anyway, now that felt honest. That felt risky. Right. I thought long and hard about whether to do that. But tellingly, you know, I didn't get an ounce of stick from anybody about it. It was extraordinary. You know, still, oh, thanks for that. You know, nobody said to me, you're a bit of a weirdo. Nobody said, you're no Christian. Nobody said you ain't Muslim or whatever. No, it was just incredible, really, to me. But with the alcohol, I never felt like that. The only thing I felt a little bit like that about was bringing my friends in, I suppose, particularly my dad, I suppose. But I really didn't. I just thought, well, I didn't even really have any sort of public health sort of fervour about me to try and change the world. I just thought, my thought was, look, I think it's interesting that so many of us, basically because alcohol isn't affecting us too badly in any obvious way, that we think, oh, we're not alcoholics, we're not addicted, we haven't got any kind of issue, we're just fine. I just thought, well, to a lesser or greater extent, that's just balls. Because if you're drinking every day and you would really worry about going out without a drink, at some level you are addicted. And I just wanted to get that across. I never really thought, oh, I'm leaving myself open here, you know, at all. I must say, I don't know, perhaps I was naive. And really, how has it affected me detrimentally since? You know, it just hadn't, people have said, thanks for the programme, really honest. I suppose it might come, is let's say I was out somewhere and let's say there was some incident, I got into a, not that it happened, but I mean, you know, somebody had a go at me in a pub about something, or I was out somewhere, or I had a car accident or something. Then I could imagine if I was in the press, it might say, Adrian Childs, comma, who confessed to drinking nearly 100 units a day, comma. Then there would be this sort of stigma around me that I was, you know, an out-of-control drinker. And that would have been unfair, you know, because it may, whether or not it was alcohol-related, it almost certainly wouldn't have been. I suppose I took that risk, but that hasn't arisen yet.
I think it was an amazing, amazingly brave and brilliant thing to do. And believe me, if I could have regulated my drinking or moderated my drinking, I would have done. I wasn't that brave. I did try, and I couldn't because you know, the reason I drank was not just because I enjoyed the taste of it. Very much like you, it was to do with bonding. It was a social thing. But I wasn't able to do that. So I really take my hat off to you for having done that.
I mean, my worry was all this, and you've been, I don't even think you believe this, and you certainly haven't even inferred it, is that what aggravates me is when, if you do manage to moderate, people will, the implication of what people say is that, well, if you've moderated, either you're kidding yourself and you're going to, you know, you're going to go back to where you were before and it's all going to be a disaster. Or if you succeed, then you obviously didn't have it that badly in the first place. Which, you know, that is the kind of inference I get from somewhere. Say, well, you weren't a proper drinker then. Well, you know, which I think is really stinking thinking. I mean, it's interesting. I know you say you do this podcast, so you want to celebrate people who are, you know, celebrate sobriety. But it's interesting, you wouldn't, the word, I mean, you're quite right to, don't get me wrong, at all. But, you know, would you celebrate my achievement in moderating with the same sincerity with which you celebrate somebody who stopped completely?
Yes, because I think that what you've done is you've been so open and so honest about your lifestyle, your choices, all of that. And you have made a decision based on those things.
Yeah.
An informed decision.
Yeah.
The thing is that people, you know, people go to the pub every single evening. They don't think about it. People go, yeah, well, it's Friday night, we'll have a drink. It's somebody's, yeah, died, we'll have a drink.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I think I do celebrate you absolutely as much, because I think your honesty will have helped other people.
I mean, to me, I just made people actually look at their own drink. And people keep coming up to me in the center of the program saying, blimey, you know, that hit home. I thought, God, I'm just like him. And that had never happened before, because programs about alcohol only ever featured the people in the heaviest 5% of drinkers, because there were loads of money shots there, blue lights, you know, being sick down themselves, you know, hospitalised, lives in trauma, drinking Pernod in the morning, all that. You know, that's money shots, that's great telly. I mean, the absolute mundanity of my situation, which I drank too much to no obvious ill effect. I mean, you know, they kept saying, no, and I got that. I mean, that's not, you know, that's not, hang on, like, this is entertainment, bloke drinking apparently sensibly. So that was the challenge with it. But so that's the reason those kind of programmes have never been made. So for that reason, when it was made, it then resonated with an awful lot of people. So, and I was just talking to Anita, this my CBT woman yesterday, and she was talking about the cycle of change, which is this sort of psychological gobbledygook, which, no disrespect, John, which I kind of, you know, I've got limited use for. But she said the cycles of change are sort of pre-contemplation, where you're thinking about maybe there might be an issue with drinking. Contemplating, you're seriously thinking about, you know, doing something about it. Contemplating, there's pre-contemplation, contemplating, and then there's ready for change, right, I'm doing it. And then there's starting change, right, starting to moderate. And then you know, you continue and we'll see what happens next. Well, what I thought, actually framed like that, I thought what the program did, it sort of fast-tracked people from pre-contemplation, straight through the contemplation stage into ready for change and even start change. It sort of fast-tracked them through that. You know, it was like a slap round the face. Come on, wake up a bit. You know, wake up a little bit here. And in a way, my motivation in stopping was, you know, I still want to be able to drink when I'm older. And that's quite a powerful message to get across to people. I said, look, you value a drink. You value a quiet pint. You know, when you're older, you might really need that. Don't put yourself in a position where you've drunk and drunk more and more and more until you're psychologically or physically unable to take any more. Just try and keep it under control. I see some people just can't. But, you know, I think, you know, with others, it's probably worth a try.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. And obviously, in my own practice,
yeah,
lots of people walk in with, you know, some people are, you know, battered and ready to stop. Others are like you, you know, contemplating change and whether they're ready. And of course, there are so many modalities out there of treatment.
I remember you said you need 3 months to reset. So if you do want a dream, remember you said just stop for 3 months and then go back to it.
Mm.
Now, that really interests me. Well, it makes absolute sense to me. I just wonder if there's any, are there psychiatrists who could give me papers written in language I don't understand, which would just basically say, yes, this supports that? Or, I don't know, where does your logic for that come from? Because my slight issue with it, well, not issue, but I've often wondered about Dry January and giving up for Lent. So often with that, people just use it as an excuse to drink more the rest of the year. Mm. As a way to say, look, I'm not addicted. Sure, I'm not addicted. How could I be? I didn't drink for all of January and I was fine. I quite enjoyed it. You know, so that's 1 month. Lent is like 46 days and nights, so it's about a month and a half. But I just wonder, and every time I've done that, I've thought, I've almost dreaded going, as I've got to the end of it, I've thought, I'm going to miss not drinking. And I thought, this is absurd that I'm going to miss not drinking. So in that case, why not keep not drinking is the obvious point. Surely, I've done a week, I'd drink sort of very sensibly. And within a month, I'm just back exactly to where I was. Now, would that have been different, do you think, if with a 3 month reset? That question is about as long as bloody Robert Peston's questions in those Downing Street press conferences, which I'm always throwing food at the telly about. But anyway, so I apologise. But anyway, does 3 months work?
Well, I'll try and give a non-Boris-like response.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think there are research papers out there to support this, which with a bit of work we could probably access.
Yeah.
They use a term through some of the self-help groups, 90 meetings in 90 days.
Yeah.
And that is based on previous research, which has come out of a lot of the treatment centres, a lot of the clinics. We use it at Abita Calm, actually, because there's the first month of the physical changes, the withdrawal symptoms, the sleepless nights, the kind of, you know, jumpy legs, and depending on your specific chemical that you're taking. So there's a psychological and a physiological side to this, which is psychologically you need to get your head around giving up. I say on that point, so you can take some power back. And I say to people, I might have even said it to you, who's in charge? Who's the gaffer? You are the drink. And people often say, well, I think I'm the gaffer. Oh, actually, I'm not the gaffer. I'm not in charge. So the 90 days gives you a serious amount of time to really fully take in some control back, because you're going to have to go through all the physical side. You're going to go through all the practical side of seeing people, of going into social situations and not having a drink. And I think there is a physiological reset beginning after 3 months, where your brain chemistry, your endorphins are getting back to normal. Because if you're taking a chemical in every day from an external source, your brain stops creating its own endorphins and its own feel-good drugs, dopamines, etc. So after 3 months, your body's back. The workers are back in the factory, if you like, the brain, and it's making them for themselves. And then after that, people often then say, I've done 90 days. I'm going to do another 90 days because actually it feels good. Some people say, I'm ready for that first drink. So it's the Dry January thing for me is not that useful. I think it's good that people have a month off, but I don't think it's a very good experiment in terms of, am I addicted or not? Because most people can struggle through a month. Most people can, what we call, white knuckle. Whereas 3 months, it's much more difficult to do. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. I just, what I keep hearing from people is that they can cope with not drinking. Well, my best mate, the one I always used to have 2 pints in the morning, he says he's fine with it. He hasn't drunk in 90 days, I think it is now, because he stopped going out before the thing because he was quite worried about it before lockdown. And he's still not drinking. And he says he's fine. He's wondering whether he'll ever drink again. But he can't imagine, and he likes going out and staying out half the night, he can't imagine having a great night out without drinking. He can have an okay night out, but he can't imagine having a great night out. And even Frank Skinner said his social life has never recovered from not drinking. Now, is this another fallacy? I mean, is it possible, I suppose my question is, to stop drinking completely and have an absolutely banging night out?
I thought actually what Frank Skinner said was really interesting about that white hot excitement. I, for a long time, didn't have that. But I had alienated so many of my friends.
Yeah, interesting.
That I wasn't fun to be around. And therefore, not many of them wanted to hang out with me. And I can honestly say in the past 13 years that I've made truer friendships. I love being around people who are drinking. I love it. I've said it before. I'm a terrible alcohol pusher at dinner parties. I would much rather be around people who were drinking because I remember how much fun it was.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I get very jumpy if people don't drink around me.
Yeah, amazing.
When they could be. I have amazing nights out. I have great nights and I get into my car at the end of the evening and I get to drive home.
How long did that take?
Took a while. Took like 3 years. 3 or 4 years. And I still have moments, absolutely, I still have moments where weddings are tricky. There are certain periods of a wedding that are tricky. Like there's like an hour and a half where everybody's drinking champagne after the ceremony. You stand there with your sort of cucumber water and you're not particularly talking to anybody if you don't know that many people. And that's hard. But I know that my life is immeasurably different, fuller, more full of genuine friendships than I ever had. And I am not for a single second saying that your friendships are not genuine because you drink together. Yeah. I'm not saying that for a second. But I got to a stage much further on when I just wasn't a pleasant person to be around. But
it's interesting that you say you'd rather others were drinking around you. So you don't need alcohol, but you need the people you socialise with to have alcohol. I hadn't thought of that, but yes, you're right. Because most people say the absolute opposite. I can't bear being with people. This is no fun because they get onto another sort of zone which you're not part of. But that's really
interesting. But maybe, strangely, that's a sort of substitute. So maybe if I think that other people are drinking, then they don't notice that I'm a bit boring. Or, you know, shy or not the centre of attention or whatever that I'd like to be, the sparkly human being. Maybe.
And you don't want to drink less. You still haven't got, there's no part of you which thinks.
Not a single part of me. Not one. I do, though, truly would like to think that heaven, if I ever get there, I would truly like to think that heaven is a tequila bar. And the tequila is on tap and that my father and I can sit down and have a good old chin wag.
I mean, you know, I'm with you both. I don't drink, you know that. I stopped a long time ago. I stopped because I couldn't cope. I was Jekyll and Hyde, unfortunately, as a young person. My mood changed so considerably when I put alcohol in and other substances, because especially when I'd had a drink, that I would lose control. And for me, the safest, and of course, like Finty, ultimately became the best route for me. And I think that's what takes us down to, back to our own physiology. I know we've got to start winding down in a second. But a lot of us are carrying other conditions. Some of us are carrying trauma. Some of us are carrying kind of really terrible self-esteem issues or body issues. Or, you know, there's so many kind of factors to why we take that medicine. But I think ultimately, you know, it does come down to, can I drink without many negative consequences? You know, as you said, if you put your life on the scales at the moment, it tips toward, I'm okay having a few drinks.
Yeah.
If you can work out, normally through some people's help, that, you know, where you are on those particular scales, then I think that's where the brave decisions come in about yeah. stopping and or having a go to control it. So I just wondered if we don't, yeah, I think this is relevant. Of yeah, course it's relevant. Having yeah. made the documentary and the Panorama program,
yeah.
you've touched on this and the book, which we're really looking forward to, by the way. Yeah. I think that would be an incredible read. What can we do? Do we need to lobby? Do we need to really? Because like I watch with my children, I don't know, whatever channel on a Sunday morning, and they're talking about cooking food and it's great. And then the wine comes out, or they're talking about the wine that complements yeah. us. And I'm like, the kids are watching. I don't want my kids to associate food with alcohol. Yeah. And there are many versions yeah. of that. So I don't know if you have any thoughts
we've
about
got to
that.
We've got to take out the social normalisation of excessive drinking, which is absolutely, you know, it's just at every level. It just overwhelms us with the advertising and the marketing message. So, you know, the single most incredible statistic that programme threw up came to me about 6 months after it went out, which is always the bloody case with everything I ever broadcast or do. And it is this, that you look at intake, you've got 5% of all drinkers, 5% of all drinkers are drinking 50, 100 units and beyond. 25%, another 25%, are drinking in the danger zone like I was, which is somewhere between 14 and 50, whatever it was. The other 70% are drinking 14 units or less. And we kept saying, like, a third of all drinkers are harming themselves. It was absolutely looking at it through the wrong end of the telescope. The incredible statistic is that of all drinkers, 70% are drinking moderately. Right. Which is incredible. You ask any drinker, what percentage of drinkers do you think are drinking 14 units or less? They'll say about 5%. I promise you. But the figures don't say that. And even allowing for difficulties in getting people to tell you how much they drink and all that, that, you know, it is at least half are drinking 14 units or less. So the thing is, be the norm. Be like most people. If I could put one advertising hoarding up there, it would be most drinkers are drinking safely 14 units or less. Be one of them. Drink with them, whatever the message is. That's the thing to get across in terms of sort of nudge policy to me. It's not impossible. It is not impossible. Most people are doing it. But drinkers kid themselves because they surround themselves with other drinkers that it is quite impossible to enjoy a drink and not drink a lot more than 14 units a week.
We know that willpower isn't enough for a lot of people. And I think this is where we still need more science, Adrian. This is where we still need...
I think it is.
The scientists to say, look, some of you can drink and get away with it, and clearly, sadly, some of you can't.
It's fascinating doing this interview. It's actually made me realise why I'm writing this book. And it's something you both said, is that you need the intervention before it becomes a problem. So, for example, when I had marriage guidance counselling, I remember the woman from Relate who was very good, and we only went after we'd split up. It was about managing the split. But she said that the tragedy is most people come to me when it's too late, sort the marriage out, you know. So I even thought, I went to a wedding shortly after that. I thought about giving us a wedding present, you know, 6 monthly checkups with Relate. I think that would be really valuable for people, you know. Yeah. It never went there. But so I'm trying to get to people who are drinking the level I was or a bit less and say, look, tackle this now and you're not after going to end up maybe in AA, maybe, you know, going to see John or whoever or be in the situation that Finty was. So get to people a bit earlier without lecturing them and, you know, still be able to celebrate the values of booze used properly.
I think if you can get, certainly for me, I can celebrate it, and I celebrate people who can drink, and all power to you, Adrian.
That's amazing.
Thank you so much, Adrian. We are really, really grateful that you took the time to come and speak to us.
Not at all.
We're also really grateful for the reviews that people are taking the time to write for us. We feel quite overwhelmed with gratitude. If you've enjoyed this episode and feel like the information contained in it has helped you, do please subscribe and leave your own review, because it really, really helps us. Thank you so much. See you next week.